Hello, everybody. Welcome to Strat Chat episode 4. Today is August the 15th, and today we're going to be talking about macro mechanics. All right, hey guys, what's up?
Hello, hello.
Right, I'm just
Hey.
gonna quickly go around and introduce everybody real quickly. Top left, we have Teuita. He's our resident Italian. Up right, we have a guest, Odin, who is a full-time writer for Acer Esports.
How's it going, man?
Bottom left is me. My webcam, like I don't move a lot on my webcam, so that's I just stand still. That's me, John. And middle bottom, we have White Wing, economist person. At bottom right, we have another guest with us today, Black Lilium, creator of the original Double Harvest mod. All right, what's up, guys?
Hey.
It's hot.
I'm
It's great
looking
to be
forward to this,
here.
actually. It's gonna be fun.
I'm so tired.
We'll manage.
Do it.
So
Lead us
the
in.
discussion of the day is macro mechanics. And I figure we'll start off by discussing what a macro mechanic is, before we really get into the nitty-gritty details of it. So, in RTS, macro typically refers to economy. So a macro mechanic would therefore, implication be any mechanic, which is the way a game does something or allows you to do something, that has anything to do with the economy in general terms.
Much.
So by that definition, mules are a macro mechanic, but so are scans, so are supply drops, so is the act of selecting a building, pushing the A key, and creating a marine. That is a macro mechanic. That is a way to expend resources. Sending an SCV to a mineral patch is also a macro mechanic because that is how you gain resources, which is an economic attribute.
Yeah, I think it's helpful too for people who don't understand the economics of it on that level to sort of differentiate as well that a macro mechanic is basically anything that affects the global game state, but not an individual unit interaction. So when we talk about macro versus micro, micro is always the action of a unit being taken almost exclusively in combat. It's something that you're doing to position, to zone, to attack or defend. Everything else that affects the global game state when you do something that expends resources or manipulates the overall state of an individual game is a macro mechanic.
I like that definition.
Sounds good.
So, in short, it's a way of building, it's a way of getting an army, it's a way of taking.
Right.
But there are some there are a few other ways of a few other interesting ways of seeing it. By the definition Odin just gave, for example, if you think about it carefully, you'll find that the act of killing workers is also a macro mechanic because you are affecting your opponent's ability to produce and affecting his economy as well.
Right.
That's a little bit more
That's a
it's a
stretch.
bit of a
Cloudy.
stretch, but yeah.
It's a little bit more murky,
Yeah.
but it turns out to actually still be a macro affecting game mechanic.
Fair enough.
So I mean, that's the basic gist is that's just what a macro mechanic is. It's anything that affects the economy or global game state mechanically. So
In that way of saying, you could also say the way you move the army as a whole can also be a macro mechanic. Right?
I don't think so. I mean, I think positioning, zoning, engagements, those are the definition of micro. That's where you have to take the active opportunity to do something that doesn't allow you to grow your army or your economy or change tech. It doesn't change the game state, right? If you were to play a game of, that the resources on the map are all mined out, there's no ability for you to spend any additional money because there's no resources left on the map, and all you have is your army left and you're moving it and choosing engagements. That's all micro. Like, macro has to change the global game state, whether that's adding resources, new tech, something that
Yes.
manipulates the overall. Like, if there's no production, if there's no resource gathering, there's no macro occurring anymore.
Yes, but you're talking about details of how you move the army, but the general notion of I'm defending or I'm attacking or I'm expanding thing, that can be attributed as a way of doing a macro, and it definitely influences the macro of you and the macro of your opponent.
I actually do agree with that, because you can reposition your army to deny bases or to gain bases, which is definitely a macro notion. But I hesitate to call it a macro mechanic, because it's not a game mechanic that is inherently macro oriented. It can just lead to.
It's a causality thing. Mm-hmm. We're having the same conversation. We agree on principle as to what you mean, but the causality is the other way around. You're taking a new base or denying an opponent's base or killing workers or any of those examples that influence global game state are influencing the state of macro, but they are not macro mechanics the way that Joel has just sort of defined them. Okay. And that's, well, we're in the same place though.
Right. It would be stupid if you move your army and shoot something and it has absolutely no impact on the economy, right?
Right. It absolutely does have an impact on the economy, but it's not the primary intent of that mechanic, I guess is a good way of describing it.
I think Lilium is thinking about is the easiest example is when you make the example of you have to push into a Zerg to keep him from droning. That specific action does affect the state of the game and of the economy because of how Zerg production works. And you kind of have the same thing less obvious in other matchups, like when Terran pushes with his two medivacs against the Protoss has to cut probes, as another example. There are situations where an attack is designed, or an army movement of some kind is designed to affect the state of the game. But that's a decision you make in-game. It's not like an actual key press or whatever, which is where...
It's not a mechanic. It's a decision-making factor. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's kind of a strategic thing where your opponent makes the decision to stop using a macro mechanic for a short time to respond. But army positioning can certainly have impact on the economy, but it's not inherently a macro mechanic in and of itself. Okay. So I think we've clarified that pretty well. So thanks for that. Why don't we? The next bit I wanted to get into was the definition of an opportunity cost, because we can't really discuss trade-offs of macro in any way, shape, or form without the notion of an opportunity cost. So who wants to give a crack at that?
I suggest the economist goes first.
Okay. Well, in economics, an opportunity cost is anything that is not monetary that you give up in order to attain something. So if I want to go spend a day at the beach, I have to give up a day of playing mini golf instead. I can't be in both places at once doing both activities at once. So that is an opportunity cost. It's important to note that an actual direct cost monetarily is not considered an opportunity cost. There is a distinguish between the two. So in StarCraft, for example, the most obvious opportunity cost would be the use of energy on one spell instead of another. So when a ghost pops a bunch of snipes, he's giving up an EMP for those. Or when a Terran drops a mule, he's not dropping a scan with that energy, or a supply depot drop. Energy is a direct resource, but since it's not a one that you have to go out of your way to gather, it simply builds itself over time. It's not typically considered a monetary resource like minerals or Vespene gases.
Okay, yeah, right. An opportunity cost can't reflect anything that you can accrue the resource for. So your energy is not something that you can choose to actively get more of. It's just regenerated at a static rate. So the opportunity cost is just when you expend it, what are you expending it on? And by using it on one thing, you can't use it on the other.
However, in the case of mules versus scan, if you put a scan, you are in a way losing 300 minerals, right? But it's still often referred to as an opportunity cost rather than a direct cost.
Right. It's actually very important to be very careful in that distinction. In economics, you would not actually ever refer to that as spending 270 resources or 300. It is very clearly the cost of a scan is exactly 50 energy and no mineral amount. It is the mule is an opportunity cost, but it's very important to be very careful when you specify that it's not an actual 270 cost of the spell because you didn't gain 270 from spell dropping a mule. It's exclusively an opportunity, not a mineral cost. It does not, for example, it would be a 270 mineral cost if it cost you 270 minerals to cast the spell, and the mule equivalent was it gained you 270 and paid that back, for example. or
well,
not
or
using it.
If you couldn't gather those minerals, right? If you had no other way to gather those resources, if there was no other way you could get them, if they were additive to the game in such a way that when you used a mule, it generated more resources than if you just gathered those minerals using SCVs, then that would technically be part of the opportunity cost. But in this case, it's not. You can still mine all of those minerals exactly the same way organically using regular workers. So the opportunity cost is strictly the spell cast.
Yeah, that gets very complicated very quickly.
Yeah.
Very.
Yes, yeah. But if the base is saturated, you get an extra 270 minerals, which you would not be able to gather through SCVs.
Right. That 270 minerals is an opportunity cost, but it's not a direct cost. And it is important to differentiate that. A scan does not cost 270 minerals. It costs 50 energy. 50 energy for a orbital command happens to, if you choose to, be worth 270 minerals. But sometimes. I mean, there's always cases where somebody like comes in and kills the mule, or the mineral patches expire, or some all sorts of other shenanigans can happen. But so we'll get to, I guess, since that's what you that's where we went first, we may as well talk about Terran first.
Fair enough.
So we mentioned earlier that anything that deals with the global state is a macro mechanic, but we may as well focus on the ones Blizzard decided to focus on recently and start off with the orbital command and the mule. So, Chris, what would you like to say about the mule?
So the thing that I don't like about the mule, is I feel like in a lot of cases, a mule doesn't really have much of an opportunity cost. Like, you don't drop a mule and you go, oh man, I really wish I needed a scan, except for like very, very specific scenarios.
DTs.
But like outside of like maybe once a game, you never have to make any kind of decision with mules. It's always, you always drop them on cooldown as soon as you have enough. And so one of the things that bothers me about mules is that there's never a moment in your mind where you have to make any kind of decisions. It kind of feels I guess it's in a way it's closer to build like straight up just building an SCV every 40 seconds or something like that. You know, it's just something you do repetitively over and over that doesn't actually have much of an opportunity cost to it.
Okay,
I think it's. Can I go?
Dale.
Okay, Dan. I think it's actually more halfway between the races. Like for Terran, there is some choice to it, whether you want to scan maybe an observer or an overlord or whatever. So there isn't that much of an opportunity cost, but compared to another mechanic that I don't like much, which we will discuss later, there is still some.
we'll get there, Teo. We'll get his rant time. I tend to agree more with Teo on this one. There actually is, especially in TVP, There actually very much is a good deal of decision making and strategy involved in the use of it. If you recall back in Wings of Liberty, a player by the name of Aya Koic came up with a build that actually didn't use mules for a long time. He actually rushed a supply drop as part of the build, and the build didn't work if you dropped a mule instead of a supply drop because you didn't have time to get a supply depot down with it. And it was a really cool TVT build that worked quite well for a while until they started patching some stuff.
Because it saved time, right?
Yes, it saved time. It was a 100 mineral return immediately, and plus the minerals saved from the SCV having to build and the time involved in building the SCV or the supply depot. And you needed supply immediately in order to protect yourself. You needed to get some Hellions out.
To be fair, that's some very specific case, and that hasn't happened often. But in general, you do have the situation where you choose between mules and scan more commonly, even in TVT. When you want to scan some position for your tanks to shoot, you have that in TVZ when you want to clear creep. So there actually are decisions to be made there, which is kind of cool.
Lillian wants to bring up a topic real quick, and I think it's probably a good time to do it. So go ahead, Lillian.
Okay.
So the way I like to look at the macro is to parameterize it with three numbers, or like three ways that the macro interacts. The first one, the most obvious one, is the income, how much money you get, how much gas you get, how persistent it is over time. The second one is the army production. how fast you produce your army and how the macro can influence that. You can build more buildings. You can add add-ons like reactors. And there's a tech time. By tech time, I mean the whole tech structure. And the example you just gave that you get an instant boost in your supply is like a shortcut in your macro, and it speeds up the army production. So, and all the macro mechanics that are there, that's not just the influence on the income, but it's an influence on speed of army production and the speed of your tech tree and upgrades, etc.
Yep. So, in short, a macro mechanic effect can easily have an impact on a lot more than just the actual direct mineral or Vespian gas return or expenditure. In this case, the Iacoic build I just brought up, which, if I recall correctly, was a two-factory starport Hellion Banshee play without reactors on the factories, because you didn't have time to build the add-on, and you needed a couple Marines out to survive early game, and you just got a couple Hellions out, and you dropped the supply drop instead of a mule because you immediately needed access to supply to afford the high-tech units, and you didn't have time to build them and rush the tech out at the same time. So that was an impact where you could tech faster by the use of a supply drop than you could by with a mule. You can have effects on map control and space. The notion of scan, for example, is very very frequently used for information gathering, which is an overall strategic decision, which is not a resource gain in any way, shape, or form with Theron. Mules can do things other than just mine resources. They can also repair. You can expend that macro mechanic to, you know, protect a unit, keep a unit alive for a short period of time across the map or in other places where you weren't expecting to need it. There's all sorts of – I've seen people use it to attack economy by finding an unprotected base and dropping a mule bomb on it just to mine a bunch of minerals away from them.
Yeah.
there are a lot of impacts these mechanics can have on things other than just gaining resources or expending them. That's another thing. I want to bring up the add-ons for a moment. Because most people who discuss macro mechanics like to skip over add-ons. The way the add-ons work is entirely a macro mechanic. You spend time constructing these add-ons to gain a benefit in some way. Tech labs give you more unit options and research options. Reactors are a way of gaining faster unit production. It should be noted that the reactors are mostly just a resource-saving, time-saving mechanic. In the early game, reactors are typically used in order to save time on tech. So in TVZ, you build the factory and you build the reactor on the barracks so you can swap them so you can immediately get two Hellions out as soon as the factory is done. But after that point, reactors are mostly just a way of saving money on production. So you can build a reactor which costs 50 minerals and 50 gas instead of building an extra starport. I mean, you could build the extra starport and make just as many Vikings and just as fast, but it's the extra starport's a good deal more expensive than a reactor is.
There's also one more thing, which is the add-ons allow Terrans to tailor their builds in a very specific way to hit a specific timing. For example, the reactor Hellions. And it's not just making your production easier or whatever, just making your production easier at a certain point in time, which is really important.
Yep, it saves time on tech production. You can get higher tech units out a
lot
faster.
Unit, both tech and unit production.
It also makes Terran a little bit more versatile because you can swap buildings between the reactors and the tech, what's it called?
Lab.
Whatever.
Tech lab.
Tech labs. So, for example, in one moment you want to get a lot of Vikings and then you switch, for example, with barracks to get a lot of Marines, right? And if you simply build additional buildings, you don't have that kind of flexibility.
Okay. I think that's a good point because it kind of gives Terran a special type of flexibility that other races that Protoss doesn't have.
Well, it does sort and of. It doesn't. Because if you think about the Protoss production setup in general, ignoring warp gates for the moment, every Protoss structure can produce every unit without a tech lab.
True.
You don't need tech labs on him in order to produce all the units available at the structure. And effectively, the extra Protoss buildings that unlock the tech aren't really any different than building an armory to get access to Hellbats or a fusion core to get access to battlecruisers. The researchers are on the structures themselves instead of on the tech labs, but on a gateway, you don't need to have a tech lab attached in order to build adepts or to build stalkers or to build High Templar. You just need the unlocked single structure. So in that sense, while the add-on design is for flexibility, if you were to take that mechanic away, it doesn't necessarily mean the Terran would lose flexibility. It would lose the need to have that flexibility.
I was more looking at the reactors rather than tech plants.
Yeah, I think, the thing that's weird about reactors is I feel like it allows you, like, for instance, Hellions is a big deal. Like, you can tech up to Hellions fairly quickly, or Vikings, or Medivacs, and then the reactor allows you to get a lot of units out a little bit faster than you would normally, and it kind of, in some ways, I'm trying to find the word, it kind of, like, manipulates what would otherwise be, like, quote-unquote, normal production in a macro way.
Yeah, well, it doubles, effectively, it doubles the speed of the production, and then you can swap it to another building so that then you produce it from a different tech lane. On the Protoss side, the Simic Alarm mechanic that you can achieve is through Chronoboost. You either Chronoboost a Stargate or you Chronoboost a Warpgate or or a different building.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to come back to that. The sort of focal question at this point is, with respect to Terran macro mechanics and particularly the Mule, what are the different sort of decision-making opportunities that arise from that? And to White Wing's point, right, tangentially, we have to raise things like Tech Lab versus Reactor because it has implications for the structure of decision-making and opportunity cost within the overall design of Terran.
Yeah, it's just generally a good thing to point out. The add-ons are completely unnecessary, except maybe the reactor. If you were to take the tech lab out of the game and just let all the buildings produce all the units if you had an extra structure. Imagine, for example, if the armory allowed you to produce every unit built by a tech lab on the factory, just by having an armory. So having an armory unlocked siege tanks, hellbats, etc.
That would be so much worse.
it would certainly modify the game quite a bit, and I would be blowing up the armor. I'd be immortal dropping armories all day long.
It's true.
Yeah.
But it's not inherently something that's necessary for flexibility. It's just that the design choice was to limit Terran's flexibility in order to promote build orders that encourage flexibility. I guess is what I would probably say about that.
It is also a control of what you can actually reactor up and what you cannot. Because if you have a reactor, you don't have a tech lab.
It's true, there's an opportunity cost there, too.
That is also an opportunity cost. And if you get stuff in the armory, then you just put reactors in everything. So it's an opportunity cost, as we mentioned before, between access to every unit at a building and... building more of the lower tech units all at once as fast as possible. So the add-ons are a very interesting design, and they exist because the basic idea is that you promote ingenuity by putting limitations. People come up with new ways of doing things because you limit what they're able to do. And that's basically just the birth of genius, is just putting limitations and seeing what people can do with it. Back to what Blizzard has decided to do, removing the Mule. What implications do we see coming from that, and do we think it's a good thing and why? So why don't we have let's start with Odin telling us what he thinks what effect this is going to have on viewers, people who watch rather than just playing the game.
Yeah, so I mean, the Mule as a macro mechanic for Terran right now has a very sort of visible impact, I think, on the situation where Terran player is playing from behind. It has a very obvious and visible impact on the situation where a Terran player has been the victim of effective harassment. They do not have any other ability to quickly generate additional workers or supplementary income because they can't quickly replace SCVs the same way that you could chrono boost out probes, and obviously we'll come back to chrono boost, or quickly spam out a lot of drones using a large number of larvae. So I think it's something where you know that the Terran player has this sort of decision-making opportunity in their back pocket, and as a viewer you look for it. You look for the base where, you know, the Terran player has sacrificed all of their SCVs in a big push, trying to get sort of the timing attack, close out a game, wasn't successful, and now has to use an aggressive level of mules to try and recover from that situation. That's obviously something that is only possible because of the current design of the Mule, and I mean, for better or for worse, has that sort of deleterious impact on whether or not you could do things like pull the boys, right? But it, fundamentally, it does have a very visible, constructive impact on the way you expect to see the game play out and how the Terran player plays when they are behind. That's for players who really understand the game in depth, right? For a casual viewer, that implication is maybe not as obvious, but you do also see it in, I mean, if you watch any decent amount of StarCraft, you are going to see a game where a Terran player playing from behind is forced to use mules as a method of recovery from a successful drop, harassment play, take your pick. It is something that you see strong players factor for, and you recognize what they're doing when it occurs.
I think the lack of mules can also impact the army composition of Terran, because mules put some kind of imbalance between minerals and gas. So you can focus more on mineral-heavy units in order to spend all your resources. Now, you take mules out, then you get more gas compared to minerals, and that maybe it will introduce more mech play.
That's actually a really good point. I hadn't thought of that about that ever.
There is some
ratio,
there, right?
Income ratio. Yeah,
yeah. The standard income ratio is different, but you also have the only race that has that efficient way to spend purely minerals, right? That's also a design situation where only Terran really... Well, really, I mean, how many units can you produce on purely minerals? Terran has the most choices and the most flexibility there.
One.
Well, Hellions and two. Marines, but Zergs have a great deal of tendency to flood a lot of Zerglings when they just have an extra minerals if they need to.
True.
So Terran does have more options to mineral dump. Zealot spam isn't the most useful thing anymore.
No.
Well, I think the idea, but the point is that like a majority of like your core composition is made up of these mineral heavy units, versus
as bio, yeah.
Yeah, versus as something bio, yeah. Versus something like, you know, Protoss, where it's all these gas heavy things. So with less minerals coming into Terran, does that mean we're going to have a shift more towards a gas-heavy composition like mech?
That's actually a very good question. I hadn't really thought too much about that. Off the top of my head, my answer would be not necessarily. I expect you'll probably see more people trying it for a while, but you've got to remember that similar things were taken away from the opposing players. So bio's relative strength to what opponents can do to respond to it may not have decreased. And typically people who were playing mech didn't mule as much anyway. They would scan more than people who were playing mech because the extra minerals didn't really serve much purpose for them. Mm-hmm. So taking away the mule from them doesn't really impact the mech player as much.
Yeah.
So the relevant question to me is whether or not the decreased mineral income for the bio player affects his resource enough that it weakens him relative to what the opponents can do to respond to it. And I can't give you an answer whether that's going to be the case or not. We're just going to have to wait and see, I think.
I think in the late game, the difference might be actually quite substantial. When you have
in the late
five,
game,
six...
Yeah, in the late game, I agree it's going to be significantly different because Terran can no longer sacrifice SEVs to get a much bigger army and make up with it with mules. If Terran throws all their SEVs away, they're just not going to have any income left.
I think it's also more difficult to, like, a lot of games you see these scrappy in-game situations where Terran's just, like, mass-producing, like, only Marines and doing incredible micro with, like, you know, 30, 40 Marines. But, like, that may not be as possible without the mules there to give you that huge boost in economy.
Yeah, I mean, you still have the decision-making ability to structure your resource income around where you want to invest your SEV time. So it's not like you couldn't choose to maintain the relative resource ratio that you can achieve now. It's more of how do you sustain that with the larger number of workers required to sort of feed into the like right now, there's this very obvious sort of positive feedback loop where you spend your excess orbital command energy on mules to generate additional minerals that you're using for quick defensive marines or additional marines for drops, and they become sort of this nonstop supplementary unit because the race has that sort of positive engagement where it says, yes, we want you to make extra minerals. You have an easy way to achieve this. And the mule has a much longer and more significant period where it's relevant in the game than something like the supply drop. The supply drop ceases to be as relevant in the late game because you're no longer at a point where it's useful, whereas the mule is consistently useful until the whole map is mined out. And that obviously doesn't occur in very many professional level matches or many matches at all. So it basically, for the entirety of the game, you have that system that says, yes, you're going to generate minerals at a rate of X. You're going to have this amount of space in your supply because you are generating additional money without having to build additional workers. And that all continues to sort of flow into this very natural sequential thing. Like it's, how many people did we watch over the years do the like filter bronze to masters pure marine strategy that was so incredibly effective at teaching people the fundamentals of macro?
One more question I would like to ask. If we remove mules and Terran focus more on supply drops, can we expect more early aggression because of that?
No. I would say not necessarily because... Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so it's... I want to discuss supply depots for a moment. I wanted to mention this earlier. I got lost in my notes, but... So supply, I want to point just how what supply is as a mechanic. Supply as a notion is a macro mechanic. It's a resource that you have to spend resources directly on to gain to trade off for. Supply depots are a tax on unit production. Is a good way of thinking of them. Every time you hit 8 supply, you have to drop 100. You have to drop 100 extra minerals on being able to produce more, or you can just not make them no more units. And the primary function of the supply depot is to weaken early game rushes. It's if you're doing a tech strategy and your opponent's doing a massive rush strategy and making a lot more units than you are, he has to spend extra resources on the supply tax, on spending extra minerals on building supply depots and spending extra time on building supply depots so that he's actually able to come out and attack you enough units. And it weakens early rushes. StarCraft II is a game design is actually very good with its supply, because it allows for secondary function on all those supply structures and units. Pylons provide an energy field, which is necessary for other purposes, for warp-ins and other things. Supply depots can be raised and lowered, and therefore are actually very useful in building walls and for zoning. Overlords are scouting units and can do and have a few extra abilities on them that can do other things. So StarCraft II is very good about making the tax useful for other things as well, but it is still a tax. Supply drop as a mechanic weakens that tax production on rushes. But typically speaking, people were dropping mules because they were better for during their rushes, because mules were still better than supply dropping for a rush. You were still getting more income to produce units faster. Mm-hmm. So I would not expect to see necessarily just because mules removed, but because of the fact that Chrono Boost is also removed and the Larva Eject is also modified, it's very hard to say who's going to wind up weakened the most from it. My guess is that Terran is probably hit the least hard with this change at the high end of play, because supply drop was never really that much worse than a mule. It was worth approximately 140 minerals in itself. It didn't mine your bases out faster like mules did. And it was instantaneous rather than over time. So it really wasn't that much worse than a mule. It was worse, but it's really hard to say.
You think we'll get to a point where, go ahead.
I don't think it makes any sense to discuss micromechanics in the context of balance because we have no idea what's going to happen. We don't even know if Legacy of the Void is completely broken or not yet. Could be.
Right, I wasn't really trying to get into balance per se, but more the question of whether this promotes early rushes more or not as a design. And it's unfortunately that answer is going to depend on the balance at specific game points in time in which we can't really judge. I think
it's not just. I forgot what I was thinking. Fuck. Never mind. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, the implication of the mule on early game attacks is going to be fairly muted because they've made enough global changes to the early game with the starting worker count and the way that resource acquisition works because of that, that the game has a lot more stability, and there's also still, we're not going to get into it, but there's still a lot of room for them to control for that kind of variable using things like map design, right? And there's a lot of space for them to have big influence and impact on how the game plays out in the earliest stages of the game using those variables. The mule, present or absent, really isn't going to be significant in that respect. It's macro mechanics, by their nature, do not have short-term impact. They have long-term effect on the way the game is played. The bigger the macro mechanic, the more influential it is, the more significant it is on the global game state over the course of a game, rather than any individual like snapshot in time.
Yeah.
Like a mule, one mule being used in the early game doesn't matter and has basically zero bottom line impact on the state of the game after a 20-minute game is over. But all of the mules used in that game add up to a significant factor that, when taken out of the equation, contextually means something. Like, that is actually an impact on how that game would have played out.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think also, in some ways, it removing the mule would also slow down a lot of aggression in a lot of ways, because minerals actually equal gas. This is like a weird abstract idea, but like, say for instance, like your natural was a gold base, that means that after you expanded you could get gases much earlier in your build order because you would have more minerals to fill up the normal ratio that you would have, right? With less workers, right? So if we go in the opposite direction, if we remove mules, you have less minerals early, which means gas comes a little bit later, which means that all the teching and stuff like that also comes a little bit later. So I think that also slows down a lot of the aggression as well.
What about the game? Yes,
no. Like you have to think that
on supply depots.
That's true.
Well, and the initial cost of the orbital and the time that takes offsets when the first mule hits. So the very first mule is not as impactful as the sum of the mules over the course of time, right? Like, it's, if anything, the change that would occur in the early game for Terran is the pressure to go immediately to an orbital command would be muted. And instead of spending that 150 minerals on the orbital command, you might choose to spend it on an additional barracks because you don't need mules as aggressively, because over the course of the game, if you give up one early scan, that's not as impactful as giving up one early mule.
I actually don't think that's going to happen.
Neither do I. I'm just saying, math purposes.
Well, no, because getting the orbital command as early as possible, I think it's still the right thing to do, because the supply drop is worth an immediate, instantaneous 100 minerals on your builds. You can actually cut a supply depot for a minute to get the orbital to get some stuff faster. The moment the orbital command ends, bam, instant supply depot.
But how long does it take your research orbital? Like, wouldn't you end up having been able to build the supply depot just as fast and for less minerals? Like, that's an opportunity cost problem, right? Like,
but you're missing the opportunity cost. The opportunity cost is the production time for SCVs versus value gained for the first for getting the energy early, for the amount of energy you gain by starting it sooner, is where the real trade off is. And I think getting that energy, and I think the 140 minerals that you get from effectively a supply drop because of the build time from the SEV not mining minerals, in addition to the 100 the supply's worth, is worth more than the time spent building SEVs that it takes to finish the orbital command. And that's where the real trade-off is, because what do you give when you start building the orbital command, apart from the 150 minerals to build it, because you're going to build it anyway. You're going to want the energy anyway, unless you're building a planetary fortress.
Yeah, planetary fortress mains. Let's do it.
You better.
Nice. The real trade-off is what are you really losing when you're, during the time it's building? Is what you're losing is building SEVs during that time, because you can't build SEVs during that time. So the question is whether the supply drop and scan at being able available sooner is worth cutting SEVs for that short time. And as it turns out, it actually is just for supply drop.
I think in some ways it also in some way makes Terran early mid game a little bit more stable, because if you think about like. You aren't sitting constantly at zero energy all the time on your orbital. Like, you don't have to drop a mule all the time. You can save a lot more for scans and things like that. And there's a lot less of that, like, oh, my opponent went DTs and I didn't build my eBay fast enough.
Yeah, like Terran will never die to DTs ever again with the removal of mules, ever.
That's true. Yeah.
Also,
I'm not sure
in
about
the
that.
In the late game, you may actually see much more planetary fortresses in the expansions.
Yeah, that's also true. That's another. I think with the removed opportunity cost, now you don't need mules or whatever. Like, a planetary fortress might be a better option at your natural or your third.
That's a decision making. Yeah, I think it's a decision making thing that exists in the game today. It's just the breakpoint will occur earlier. The value of successive orbital commands will be decreased because there's effectively a finite amount of scan or supply drop that you can make use of, and there isn't in the same way quite the same breakpoint for mules, so you tend to see people go like third, in some cases fourth orbital before they start building planetary fortresses right now, and that number could be drastically reduced. You may only need two, worst case maybe three, but the only benefit that the orbital command retains over planetary fortress at that point in the game is mobility, the ability to pick it up and move it.
Yep. The only, before we get into the next race, there's one other thing I wanted to mention. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was off the top of my head because I blanked just a second ago. Scans, right. The thing is that, as you mentioned, it's decreasing opportunity cost because you're removing one of the spell options, and typically the one that was considered the strongest. So the opportunity cost of a scan has just decreased. If it were my decision, because it's relatively easy to defend a natural expansion, this Terran, like you don't really need a planetary there to defend it. I would still be building orbitals to even the third base still, and I'd just be using tons of extra scans compared to where we did in Heart of the Swarm to get tons of information, always keep track of my opponent's positioning, see what's in his base at all times, et cetera, et cetera. I'd be scanning nonstop.
I feel like that could get to a broken level, maybe.
Well, but one thing you've done is you've decreased the Terran comeback. That's where I wanted to talk about. You've decreased the Terran comeback mechanic, because by removing mules, Terrans have significantly less comeback potential once they fall behind. But in exchange for that, you've given them greater safety by allowing them to, by justifying scanning more frequently for that safety. So while Terrans, once they fall behind, will have a harder time coming back, they're also safer and harder to get them to fall behind in the first place. So I don't necessarily think that's inherently problematic. We'll see how that plays out. But it is a change.
I'd just like to say that I like the fact that a Terran can come back with mules. I think it's like it's flashy, but it's great that games like MVP against Tafel can happen.
That game should have never happened.
That Innovation versus Leanok game on Whirlwind, where Innovation fell ridiculously far behind from a boss, and then Hellbat dropped Leanok to death in 20 minutes while mueling. Stuff like that. But the comeback potential is there. It still exists because you can still harass your opponent to catch up and buy time to play catch up. Legacy of the Void limits comeback potential significantly in general because of the reduced mineral patches. Bases mine out faster, and you can't, when you're behind, it's exceedingly difficult to secure an additional base. Mm-hmm. So comeback potential is already heavily hit in Legacy of the Void for all races, because once you're behind, your opponent can just put the squeeze on you, and then, well, sorry, there's not much you can do from there, other than max out, get one last army, and try to do something. But one of the nice things about the mule being gone is Terrans will mine out slower in Legacy of the Void now. You can't mine the minerals as fast, you won't mine out as quickly, and supply drops do one thing that's nice, and that's create permanent extra resources on the map. So, that we'll see. Have to see how that plays out. So why don't we move on to the race I know Teo's been itching to complain about.
yes.
And this is going to be the biggest, I think, discussion out of all three races. Let's talk about Zerg. Okay. So Teo, why don't you rant your way into starting us off on this one?
So I fucking hate Inject with all my heart. I hate it. Because it makes Zerg so ridiculously stupid. Like, the only thing that matters with Zerg, or almost the only thing that matters, is injecting. I can't remember just how many times commentators are like, the Zerg is gonna micro so well, let's switch to the first person view, and then the guy A moves and injects. And we're talking about people that get the GSL finals. Not that.
People get the GSL finals 5 times?
Yeah, exactly. Just... people who will not be named further, but who get the GSL finals 5 times.
And then lose every time in the finals?
Yeah.
I did some math.
So much less interesting.
I did some math, and injects actually boost your larva production by 150%.
Nice.
Yep. Are you referring to the 2 increase or the 4 increase?
4 increase.
And that's per hatchery.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, the math, so, I think there
it,
works
it,
out.
It's crucial.
It's so obscene that, like, if you remember when Kespa players first switched, you had Jadon microing individual infestors like they were the filers and losing games because of it, because he wasn't injecting properly. Like, on the one hand, it's nice that Zerg has a ridiculously high skill cap that no one is even remotely close to because they don't micro. But on the other hand, injecting is so important that it's too big. And the other thing I dislike about it is it makes Zerg so bipolar in terms of either droning massively or making massive amounts of units that it's next to impossible to attack into them without a way to escape for free. Because they can just flood you with units they built in the last 20 seconds. Which is why I usually attack with recall or medivacs, or that's it, sort of. And that's the end of the first round.
Okay, we'll come back to this rant number 2 in a minute, because I know he's got more he wants to rant about. But like we said before, 150%. Off the top of my head, I estimated that to be correct. I think it is correct. I'm just going to trust his math because it sounds right. If that's the case, it's 150%. The queen is a 50% cost of a hatchery. Okay? Mm-hmm. So you spend an extra 1.5 times the cost of the hatchery to build the queen over just having the hatchery, and your larva production increases by 150%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I just remind you, I replied queen when you asked which unit is the most overpowered in the game, in our opinion.
The point I'm making is that it's two queens.
And to get even more boost.
Right, right. The point I'm making is that macro hatcheries don't seem to mathematically be much inferior.
No, they aren't. They're exactly the same as long as you have a queen injecting it.
That's correct. A macro versus the 4 inject, a macro hatchery is identical in efficiency. The difference is the burst of the larva. You know, you get 4 larvae all at once instead of just a dribbling of larvae over time. But it comes out to be basically the same in terms of cost versus increased production.
How?
Per hatchery.
Oh. It's four times worse.
Yeah, you're supposed to have injecting your macro hatchery anyway.
I see what you're referring to, because then you build it. Yeah, no, okay. The macro hatchery is inferior, now that I'm thinking about it. It is inferior, but it's not much inferior.
It's like three times inferior. So it's costs
Assuming you put a queen on it.
100%
right, we're discussing queen versus no queen, though.
Right, I'm discussing a macro hatch with no queen, no queens at all with a macro hatch versus a single hatchery with a queen.
Right.
I think
yes.
Like so, maybe in the short term, like
that costs you twice as much, yeah. and gives you 100% boost instead of 150% boost.
Right. Exactly. So it is worse. But the nice thing is that with the new system, 2 larvae per hatchery automatic. Macro hatcheries have improved because you're not building the. With the new system with the autocast, do you have to have a queen out to get the inject?
I would guess
so. Does the queen just sit there next? Yeah. The queen doesn't.
Yeah, I think the spell just became autocast, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Which is going to be a pain in the ass if, like, you know, you're, like, trying to micro queens or whatever, and they, like, walk over to hatchery, and you're like, what the fuck are you doing? I'm trying to defend a Viking right now. Like,
you should be able to disable autocast as with any other autocast.
Yeah, but that's annoying. Yeah,
I would expect that you can. It's iffy. Okay, so I wanted to, before we continue with the Zerg, I wanted to point out something Lillian brought up right before the show, and that was, or at least made me think of before the show, if he didn't intend to it, is this, or it might have been Odin, I can't remember who said it, somebody did. I think it was Odin, actually. This discussion of, or notion of Blizzard's changes to the economy, they're kind of contradicting each other in some ways.
That was me, yeah.
And they're going in different directions. Yeah, that was Odin. You have, the first they did the half minerals at a base, half resources. So bases mine out faster to try to, and their intent was to force you to expand quicker in the early game. Mm-hmm. And just keep expanding. They did the 12 worker start so that the economy develops a lot faster from the early game. And then they nerfed the macro mechanics, which has the direct effect of slowing down the rate of economic development. Which is kind of self-contradictory.
It is different between the races because each of the macro mechanics influences income, army production, and tech time in a different way.
Well, yes, but it still slows down in the absolute sense for all three races, maybe to different amounts, but it still slows down economic development to remove them.
There are 2 points to make. The first is that they originally introduced macro mechanics, as in mules, chrony boost, and larva, specifically to make StarCraft harder, StarCraft 2 harder mechanically. That was the original goal. Arguably, forcing people to expand faster and pay more attention to things already accomplishes that. So in a sense, macro mechanics become redundant. And the other thing you can say is that, yes, they wanted to speed up the economy, but maybe they found out the economy now was too fast and they wanted to slow it down some way. And they decided to, instead of tweaking it again, just they might as well just remove the macro mechanics and kill two birds with one stone. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion on it. And it makes sense when you think of it.
So, well, in terms of... go ahead.
Okay, and the other thing I was going to say is that the context in which I brought this up originally was I also feel like it contradicts not only their sort of early game design decisions, but also the general flow of Legacy's development insofar as trying to add more opportunity cost and engagement timing issues with activated abilities on units and things like that. Because the impression I get, and I'll come back to this more when we get to the Protoss, because that was sort of what spawned this conversation in the first place, but good gameplay in the game appears to be creating some push and pull where most of the units in the game now have energy-based abilities, cooldown-based abilities, and there's all these sort of decision-making and micro-opportunities where active choices can be made in the front line, and pushing those buttons to improve your units in the short term is part of the good gameplay design. And I take issue with the fact that we are scaling back on the macro side and asking players to make less of those decisions and do less of that same thing on the macro side, because I don't understand how one can be good gameplay and the other can't. And I, as a player and as a viewer, I feel like you don't see the impact of macro and you see the impact of micro, and so they're trying to shift the emphasis there. But as a player, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the shift away from macro towards micro changes the nature of the game. Right? It fundamentally says, if we make these abilities autocast, if we change rate of production, if we remove the ability for players to control their timings using the macro mechanics and replace all of that with flashy gameplay and more activated abilities and more spellcasting, you're not playing StarCraft anymore. That's really the thrust of what bothers me about it.
Yes. Absolutely agree.
Okay, well, I want to... We'll come back to that notion in a few minutes, because that's a whole long discussion on its own. And we did start with Zerg, so we may as well continue with Zerg for the time being. But that there are some definite points that we want to get back to. So what is an inject? So the macro mechanic of the Zerg that we're referring to here is basically just the queen, just the unit, and what its spells do precisely. Mm-hmm. And the inject is a huge boost in larva, which is the production resource of the Zerg. Every period of time or so, you get four of them popped out. Awesome. Okay. Well, you nerf that or make it autocast and it requires less attention. Well, that allows Zerg to pay more attention to other things. Because right now, based on what we've seen from players like Sue, the actual optimal way to play the game through Heart of the Swarm was hit perfect injects to the exclusion of everything else. Like, sacrifice, throw entire armies away if you have to, if you don't miss injects. And he got to a whole bunch of you could go into his games and you could look at the replays and you could analyze the games a lot, and he would oftentimes not do flanks or other cute army tricks he could do to make engagements a lot more effective because he'd be back at base injecting instead.
Pretty sure he patrols the split banelings though, so that was pretty good.
Well, he would do that quickly and then he would run back to base rather than trying to hit an optimal baneling or he'd do a sort of a semi halfway there with the patrol, etc. And yeah. The point is he prioritized injects at every point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was by far the most successful Zerg player in Heart of the Swarm. And that sort of tells you that injecting is your highest priority as a Zerg player, making sure that your attention is being spent on that. And that is a decision. That is a decision-making skill that a lot of players lack. They oftentimes will prioritize micro or control of their armies instead. But I think the game is a lot more fun to watch and to play when it is not the correct decision to ignore your army and your units and focus on hitting injects properly.
I'm going to be honest.
When you are playing Terran and you're controlling your army, you can be quickly... hitting all your production while simultaneously controlling your army, because it all takes us a few button clicks. You don't have to move the screen. But as Zerg, you couldn't inject without jumping back to your hatcheries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so can we talk about that real quickly? Because I think that is a separate problem here, and this is one of the design factors. Like, it's a variable in the decision that's been made to remove injects the way we understand them today. They can't actually remove injects, right? That's fundamental but they're not. Okay, the decision they've made is to make inject into an ability that is autocast, interacts with the race in a different way, stymies the rate of production slightly, and is a controlled variable because they don't feel they can outright remove it or replace it. The problem with injects was never that they were like... The mechanic itself is not flawed. The flaw is that there was no ability for the player to miss them or pool that resource in any way. With all the other macro mechanics in the game, literally every other macro mechanic in the game, you can make the argument that there is value in deciding to hold back for a period of time, pool that energy to use towards something, drop a whole bunch all at once. Injects have this very peculiar interaction where stored energy is actually punitive. You do not want to be behind on injects. If you miss that timing, you are actually sacrificing something that, as you've said with the examples of Sue and other like top-tier Zergs, you fall behind. You actually, much the same as we talked about how there's sort of a value of mules over the course of an entire game, there's a value of inject over the entire game, but it's inverted. You don't actually care about the value of the injects you hit. You care about the value of the injects you've missed. And that, as a player, sucks. And as a viewer, it sucks, right? The whole experience there is that hitting injects doesn't matter, missing injects does. And that's not good gameplay, right? That's where, had they made that mechanic work differently, had it been that the charges of spawned larvae stored on the queen and you could choose to activate them at a set time by casting the spell, there would be all sorts of other ways that that mechanic could have worked within the parameters of what we understand to be the upper boundary limits on larvae and everything else today. But instead, it's just not good gameplay. And I think the choice to alter it was made because it sucked to play, it sucked to watch. But I think the direction they've chosen to go isn't necessarily the solution. And I think this mechanic is actually at the core of why they're altering macro in the first place. Because Chrono Boost is not actually punitive. Use or misuse of mules is not actually punitive. Failing to inject as a Zerg player is punitive. And they don't want there to be this punitive relationship between the player and their macro mechanic.
I think you shouldn't compare Queen Inject to mules and Chrono Boost. It should be more compared to unit queues on a buildings. If you have a barracks that is not producing a marine or anything else, this is punitive. So they introduced a mechanic on the Zerg side which acts similarly to a buildings that you have in other races, that you have to attend to every X seconds to actually press the button to continue building. Because otherwise, and that's what is going to happen with autocast larva, if you do nothing, you go away from your computer, the larva is going to stack up and stack up and stack up, and then you can throw all bunch of units. And that's not the case with all other races.
That's true.
But that's a design decision of the whole Zerg race, and I don't think they want to take away that identity, right? That is fundamental
to
unit design, too.
I don't want to take away that identity of the Zerg, but I'm just pointing out that there's a problem of the balance of the difficulties which are between Zerg and other races, that they try to address it in this way. Maybe there's a different way to address it.
I think, for me, I feel the same way about Injects as I do about Mules, is outside of, certain situations, it's one of those things where you just 100% of the time it's the right thing to do. And so I feel like lessening the Inject changes the way that it works, but I still wish there were a real opportunity cost to doing it.
Okay, so to what Black Elim said, I'm not entirely certain I agree, because there are some significant differences there. For one thing, Terran and Protoss players have the opportunity to queue up an extra unit before the current one is finished to make sure that they don't miss one. And while the optimal play is to not do so until the instant it finishes, even pro players will typically do it a couple of seconds before it finishes, because they don't have to check back. They don't have to check, so they don't have to. They can check back approximately when it's going to finish, but they don't have to check the exact instant after it finishes and then do it at a precise time or lose seconds. So it's the larva inject is significantly more punishing than the other mechanics in that sense. Further. Yeah. I would compare more towards missing production, more towards missing having three larvae at a hatchery with, and then not making units for a few seconds, so that you're wasting time, potential larva build time. Normally, that mechanic already exists.
Yes, but it's not very punishing when you have injects.
No, but in Brood War, for example, I'll Teo to the Brood War reference. Take that, Teo. If you had a hatchery which had three larvae on it, and you were not making units from that hatchery at that precise moment in time, you were losing out on permanent larva through the game. Hatcheries could not go beyond three larva, period. So if you were controlling your army too much, and then because you only had single building select, so you had to hop from building to building quickly and, select all the larva and then build the units. If you were a little bit slow doing that, you could easily lose out on larva without a larva inject mechanic being present. The same is true in StarCraft 2. It's just that typically Zergs are making units so frequently because of how high the econ is. the rate of economy is in the fact that you only usually have a few hatcheries because you're doing the larva inject stuff, that you don't really usually have a problem with keeping up on the larva's expenditure. But, I mean, it's just – the reality is that inject as it is exists now because you pretty much always want to be injecting no matter what, except in some exceedingly rare circumstances. Like you find yourself – you lost a queen and you have to get it – and you need energy for transfuse so that you don't lose more queens to a big fleet of Phoenix or something. It's – you pretty much are just always injecting, and there's not really a decision to make there. It's just a task that is given to the Zerg player to give them something to do. And the only reason you should actually have that in as a necessity is because you don't want them, because there isn't enough else for them to do, or you want to artificially force them to be fast. In order to do the stuff they do. And as we've seen in Heart of the Swarm from players like Sue, they don't care about being fast. They care about not missing injects. They'll sacrifice an entire army if they have to not miss injects, because they know it at least going to trade somewhat. It's at least going to get some kills when it dies, because it fights back automatically. So they'll, you know, they'll A move in and not try to flank or not try to hit micro spells quickly. They'll do maybe a baneling split real quick, and then just they'll just run off and inject immediately. Because if they even miss a couple seconds, they couldn't queue up an inject ahead of time, like you can as Terran or Protoss. And I'm careful not to mention warp gates here, because that's a discussion later. But warp gates you also can't queue, so it's similar in that regard. But warp gates, you don't actually need to be producing constantly. It's oftentimes the case where Protoss players will have warp gates idle on purpose. Extra ones just for an emergency. But
right, and this circles back to the problem with spawn larvae specifically, right, is that there are decision-making opportunities and strategic elements of the game that require you to withhold use of production or cease to use other mechanics, pool energy. There's always a rational way, or even to put it maybe more fairly to people who are not playing this game at a pro level, because I think we have to factor that into this discussion as well. A pro player can't afford to miss an inject, because that is the difference between winning and losing. But at an amateur level, as an amateur Terran player or an amateur Protoss player, there is room for small errors, right? You can make the small error of... Yes. Pooling energy, and if your orbital command reaches full energy and you don't spend it, you now have permanent lost cost, opportunity cost there, in the sense that you've not gained that energy and can never now get it back. But it doesn't have the same game-breaking impact as not utilizing inject. If you're not using spawn larva on cooldown, that's basically how you play Zerg, and that's something that I think they want to get away from. But I don't know that the autocast change direction is necessarily the direction to solve that. It's a direction, and it's forcing them to do similar things to the other races, but they're, like Lilium said, they're not exactly comparable. And you're comparing a production issue with a non-production issue across the other two races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can come back. Well, near the end of the show, we will take time to discuss what our own proposed changes are, and how we think you know, they should do different things differently. But I mean, just talk about what the change is and what it does at the moment. Taking it autocast, will free up attention from the players to do other things instead. So you'll get more impressive army control rather than just mass swarms, which actually becomes necessary because they now have fewer units because they have less larva. And even if they're spending, you know, building extra macro hatcheries to make up for the less larva per inject, that's more resources, so there's still going to be, in absolute sense, fewer units on the Zerg side. But now they have the ability to spend attention controlling them and flanking better and doing all sorts of other things. So I'm not sure how it's going to wind up balancing out. I don't know if it's to their advantage or not in the long run. Whether you're going to see players like Sue being better or worse, etc., etc. It's almost impossible to say now. But it is a change. And I do think it's probably a step in the right direction, because I never really liked the fact that the Zerg identity itself was entirely about how well you inject. And I think the fact that Sue made, you know, so many GSL finals and so many tournament finals, not even just GSL, consistently, and was by far the best Zerg player of that year. And he did it just by not missing injects. He didn't really do anything else particularly well. His micro was significantly worse on average than several other pro Zerg players at his level, or around that level. A lot of the stuff he did was actually by far worse. You could go into his replays or watch the VOD and see some terrible engagements from him. He still win because he hit his injects properly. And I'm not. A lot can be said about, you know, making things harder or easier in skill floors, and, you know, there should be a minimum skill level in order to play at this level, etc., in terms of this and so on and that. But the real question is where do players spend their attention? How much attention because the attention is finite. And I think there's enough stuff to do even without injects that a player will never have attention that they can't – will have attention left over to use that they have nothing useful to use it on past the early game.
You mind if I just talk for a second about, like – So I played Zerg quite a bit a couple months ago. And the biggest problem that I was having, and the part that makes Zerg pretty much unfun, is the fact that you do spend a lot of time between spreading creep and injects. You spend about 15 to 20 seconds per 40 seconds doing those two things. And so there's significantly less time to do things like micro and really pay attention to other things versus races like Terran that can drop mules and without moving their screen, they can quickly queue up a bunch more units. Protoss can jump somewhere, Chrono Boost jump somewhere else, warp in a bunch of units, and they're pretty much set. So, in a way, I kind of like the auto inject thing because it allows me it would allow Zerg players to spend more attention towards other things because they're not spending, like a whole like ha literally half of their time staring at their base. But at the same time, yeah, I agree that like it may not necessarily be the greatest direction to go.
The other
Yeah, I mean,
thing that jumps out at me as problematic is the nature of autocast spells in StarCraft, right? Moving spawn larva to an autocast ability, with every other autocast ability in the game at present, there are conditions under which you would disable that autocast. You want to control whether or not you have, like for example, autocast repair.
Oh, I think he lagged out. Kevin, are
Oh,
you
it wasn't
still
me
with
this time?
us? Yeah, it wasn't you. It wasn't you. I think Kevin lagged
Okay,
out.
well, yeah, it sounds like he did. We'll wait for him to come back. Where he was going with that, I don't actually have a problem with auto eject mechanics. It's effectively a toggle. If you think about it in that sense, it's do I want this ability used? Do I not want it used? And that's just a more effective way of making that decision than having to babysit the unit. And it's not really a question, it's not really a strategic decision whether there should be there. It doesn't modify the strategy in any way, shape, or form to have it be an auto eject. It simply changes the amount of attention required to properly execute. And the fact that in a game like StarCraft, there's so much stuff to do constantly on all over the map, every time, there's always something else you could be doing with your attention. You just prioritize it. It's entirely a decision as to where to prioritize your attention. And making something autocast makes it require less attention so you can do other stuff instead.
Am I back?
I
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
We can
Yeah.
hear
I
you again.
just feel
You're back, but we can't see you.
I just feel that if you make it completely automated, then it actually becomes too easy for the Zerg not to look into the base at all compared to other bases. I agree with you that other races don't have to look that often to cast their Chrono Boost or a Mule, but there's still a difference, I believe.
No,
The point
it's
I
Protoss. I pretty much never looked except it's Terran and Protoss. When I was looking at my bases, the only time you ever really look at your base, or should if you're executing your play properly, you only ever look at your base when you're placing a building, or when you are using your macro mechanic, which is the same requirements for Zerg, except they simply place fewer buildings over the course of the game. But
And they don't
you
macro
don't.
anymore. And they don't
Right.
Okay.
There
Hold
is that.
But Terrans and Protoss really don't look at the base that much either.
I think the
Yeah,
biggest
but
problem with larva inject is not necessarily the reason that you need to click, but the importance of it. That
yes.
150%. Imagine that it was like only 50%. You get one extra larva or two extra larva instead of four, and then if you missed it, you're not penalized as much.
Well, it's 75% now with the two change, right?
Yeah, a
Well,
little
and
bit something.
the thing
it's
is that
the
missing it would still be a problem for the global macro state of your game, right? And it wouldn't be something that you can recover because it's not like if you miss your inject and you start at 5 seconds late, the inject takes five less seconds, right? It would be different if you could pool that time on your queen or something, but you can't. It's still always under the current design, it's always going to be punitive. The other thing that really rubs me the wrong way about making it an autocast ability is with every other autocast ability in the game, there are conditions under which you turn autocast off, right? You turn off autocast heal on your medevacs because you want to save that energy, or you turn off autocast build interceptors on your
People turn that
carriers
off.
if you ever build them. They can. Yes. There's a reason for it at times.
I don't think I've ever seen a player actually turn it off when he had units that needed healing.
You can hit a marine.
At any rate, there are reasons under which you would choose to deactivate it. There's literally zero cases in the new design for spawn larvae where you would ever disable it. Like, you would never want to turn it off because there would never be a condition under which that would be an appropriate decision.
I disagree, and it's the same situations that hop up in Heart of the Swarm now where you don't always want to inject. Sometimes in the early game, you will want to drop a few extra creep tumors instead of getting some initial injects if you're not doing a... If you want to play a little bit safer and not get a hyper early extra bases or econ really fast, or you're doing anything with units where you don't need that much larva, sometimes you will expect an early attack and want to pool a little bit of extra energy for transfuse. When you're getting rushed or something, and you don't have the money or income to spend the extra larva anyway, so you get the transfuse instead. There are certainly situations, for example, the most common one I encounter. When I'm playing Zerg or when I'm playing Protoss, is the Phoenix Cloud coming in at the to pick off Queens. You will oftentimes cut injects for a moment, if you can, just to save energy for transfuse, so that your Queens can protect each other. If they lift up a Queen and start killing it, you transfuse it while the other Queens are shooting, so you don't lose any Queens for a minute or so.
Yeah, I think...
At least until you get a couple extra Queens out so that you can spare the energy for injects. There are still some times where you... don't always want to inject immediately. They're just not as common.
I was gonna argue this earlier, but like, I actually don't think it. You even really need to disable it, because if you're pulling your queens somewhere, like if you're pulling your queens to the front to defend or getting ready for like a baneling bust or whatever, and getting ready for transfuse, like you're still only gonna have one queen injecting at the closest hatchery anyway. Like you don't need to disable it really, because all your queens are just gonna sit there anyway.
And you don't want to design for the edge cases.
Besides, if you're giving an order to a queen, it's not going to do auto anything.
Yeah, but sometimes they do dumb things. Queens are dumb.
It depends on how they...
Not as dumb as dragoons.
That's true.
Not as dumb as dragoons.
That's the perfect segue. There it is.
Hour and 17 minutes. We made it this far without a Brood War reference.
I made a couple before.
Oh.
Do we want to use that as our way to jump into Protoss?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's finalize the Zerg stuff one quick, and then we'll go right into Protoss. Right. So, in short, the basic premise of the change to inject. We're not going to say necessarily whether it's a good or a bad thing, because it's not. We're not the people in charge who have to judge that. But it's a change from... It basically changes how they require their attention to be spent. They're going to have fewer larvae because it's changed from 4 to 2. So they have to. So it makes their units into the units they have more important in terms of what they're totally going to have. So they can't throw units away as easily, but they have more attention to spend on controlling them. So it changes what Zerg has to do. But that's about it. I guess it also reduces their drone production rate a little bit.
Yeah, but they'll get
a little bit, so it slows their economy gain down a little bit, and that's probably a good thing, because their economy growth in Legacy of the Void compared to Protoss or Terran is a little bit disgusting at the moment. But
the only large-scale change I foresee with something like that is just more macro hatcheries. Rather than taking another expansion and getting a queen out there, like you just build another hatchery in your base, and so you have two hatcheries in your main, two hatcheries in your natural, etc.
Okay, so let's get into Protoss, and here's the one that I like the most to talk about, because it's the one that's most diverse. Chrono Boost. So Chrono Boost is the one with the greatest opportunity cost out of all of the macro mechanics that Blizzard's tweaking.
So obviously best, you're saying? Because it's Protoss?
It was overall the weakest of the three. It was overall the weakest of the three. It had the lowest impact of the three, but it was also the most interesting, because it was directly usable on increasing production of units, economy, and most importantly, it gave Protoss an entirely unique identity in that they could rush tech in a way that no other race could. Mm-hmm. You could choose a tech, and you could make it finish really fast.
Yeah, all three properties of a macro can be affected,
Right. And Terran couldn't make their tech go faster. You couldn't rush Stim any faster than other. Once you started, you just had to wait till it finished. Protoss had the ability to choose to a limited extent based on their energy, making things finish a lot faster. And that was really cool because a lot of Protoss builds, and it was very hard to see. And I'm sure when Odin returns, if he's not back yet, he'll point this out on his own. It was very hard for viewers to understand. I can't see his webcam, so I wasn't sure. But it's very hard for viewers to understand that this is the true. But it's Protoss build orders were basically entirely about where you spent your Chrono Boost.
Yes.
It was, you know, 3 Chrono Boosts on Warp Gate versus 4 Chrono Boosts on Warp Gate was the difference between an attack and a defensive build. Chrono Boost, saving Chrono Boosts, a whole bunch of Chrono Boosts would tell your opponent whether you were going to try to rush Blink out, or whether you were going to try to, or some other tech, or whether you were about to draw, or whether you had a bunch of hidden Warp Gates and were about to start pumping units like crazy because you were saving Warp Gates finished. New gateways finished. All sorts of things like that. Chrono Boost was entirely the deciding factor in the build order of Protoss. Removing that from the game entirely takes away almost all variability in build orders from Protoss. It was the least impact out of all of them, because it certainly wasn't as overtly powerful as getting extra minerals, or scanning pieces of the map, or getting huge bursts of production increases. But it was entirely based on decided how the Protoss builds went, and without it, it's going to be very hard to differentiate Protoss builds in any significant way, or make them, or improve them in any way. And it takes away the overwhelming identity of Protoss as a race, which was the ability to get tech out faster in order to compensate. Protoss was a tech-based race. And I'm not sure how they're going race. To... Well, they were before Chrono Boost got pulled away. I don't know... Yeah, they still are, but I'm not sure how they're going to remain tech-based successfully with the overall increased economy or increased game pace of Legacy of the Void, which already nerfed tech-based builds a bit because you don't have time to wait for a tech to finish before you're expanding, before you're taking your next expansion. And with the Chrono Boost being gone, they can't speed their tech up at all, so I don't know how they're going to find time to actually rely on tech. I'm not sure it's going to be a balance problem because they could still just buff the units to the point where they don't need to do it anymore. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in Blizzard's official statement, they said that if they want to remove Chrono Boost, that they'll probably have to change a lot of timings for the tech and stuff to make sure that Protoss still kind of has correct tech timings and they're not held back by lack of Chrono Boost.
Right, that's a balance.
Yeah, it's a fix, but it's not. Yeah, it doesn't actually help their identity.
It still removes their identity.
Right.
Yeah, thing is, a build timing is set in stone, whereas Chrono Boost changes that, and it's what makes it interesting. For example, for the longest time, early on in StarCraft II, Protoss players thought that one gate expand against Terran, this was before the Mothership Core, was unsafe against a variety of builds. And then we figured out that if we Chrono Boosted just the right things at just the right times, we could be safe against anything. That's really interesting for me, and removing that is just kind of sad. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, if they feel the need to slow the game down, like Chrono Boost doesn't speed up the Protoss player that much. It's why Protoss has a harder time coming back compared to mules or mass droning. So I think Chrono Boost is the mechanic that needs the least to be looked at. It's the most interesting and the one that's less extreme. So, yeah.
I don't really agree with that. I think it's actually quite hard to balance around the Chrono Boost. We have seen an increase of Warp Gate tech. We have seen an increase in Blink time. We have seen an increase of Zealot production from gateways. Because when those values were too low, Chrono Boosting them caused that, for example, 2-gate proxy was considered to be too strong. So we ended up having a heavily nerfed Protoss where the Chrono Boost was no longer a benefit but a must to use in order to actually stay even.
Yes, that was mostly a product of the maps, though.
Yeah.
Proxy 2 gate was mostly strong because maps were pretty small and you typically knew where or close to where your opponent would spawn. So they nerfed Zealot build time because just to reduce it because the maps made it too strong. They nerfed warp gate timing because it was too easy and too short to get a probe over there, and there are too many places to hide the pylons.
I disagree.
They nerfed blink because they nerfed the blink build time because blink builds were way too strong on maps with a huge huge cliffs where you could easily just run bounce and forth between the natural and the main. Blink was so dominant for a while. It was just maps like Yanzu or Cloud Kingdom, if you recall that one, stuff like that. It was Antigua Shipyards, for example, maps where Blink was so obscenely strong, and then it just broke the camel's back, they had to nerf it. That's not a product of Chrono Boost inherently. That was just the abilities being too strong so that their response was to delay them. Chrono Boost let you get it faster, but the thing is that it wasn't because of Chrono Boost that they were broken. If you'd removed Chrono Boost and just reduced the time to compensate for Chrono Boost, they still would have been broken. Chrono Boost just allows you to decide what to prioritize getting done quickly in a period of time within the limitations of your energy. So you can have a build order set in stone, and Chrono Boost allows you to react to an unexpected event by saying, "Oh crap, I'm gonna die. Let me get my units out faster. Chrono Boost the gateways." Or, "Okay, my opponent's posturing to attack, but I don't think he's really gonna commit. Let me commit to getting the storm tech done ASAP and try to buy time for it to finish, so I can use my High Templar to defend defend this attack, etc., etc." Without Chrono Boost, you can't do that at all. You have to have your builds are set in stone. You can't react in any way to speed things up a bit. You just have to have strong units and strong abilities. So, and balance wise, that's not problematic necessarily. I mean, if you make Adept, Zealots, Stalkers, etc., stronger, it'll be fine. Maybe a little bit too strong. It's going to depend, but you can make all the Protoss units and everything stronger to compensate for lack of Chrono Boost. But it's less interesting to me, at least.
Yeah. So I think the point has to be made that Lilium's point flows both ways, right? In the present game design, every unit's build time, every tech research time, all of that has to be calculated against the availability of Chrono Boost, because you don't want to create windows of opportunity where Chrono Boost would allow a Protoss player to hit an advantageous timing that is something that can't be countered, right, by another player. There has to be that sort of push and pull of Chrono Boost can't put you at an advantage inherently, right? It has to be sort of a calculated use that everything is a little teeny bit slower. Everything takes 3 seconds longer to build or 5 seconds longer to research, so that over the course of a game, the effect of Chrono Boost is relatively par. And so that if you're using Chrono Boost, you are succeeding at meeting the macro requirements of the game. And if you're not using it, you are technically falling behind. You don't have the penalty of Inject, where if you miss it, you can't use it later. That energy still exists, but missing it is problematic. The inverse is true in the modern game, right? In the current Legacy of the Void build, in the absence of Chrono Boost, not all of the build times in the game have been modified to reflect the absence of Chrono Boost. So now the game, like the whole race's design, has thematically centered around the availability of this mechanic, and they would have to go through and, I think, in my opinion, make sweeping changes to a broad set of build times for units, research times for major tech choices that have been, to William's point, modified in the past because Chrono Boost is no longer an option. Like, the whole game does actually have a sort of sense, right, in its design flow of having had that ability available, and its absence is just as punitive as its presence was, in the sense that now you can't do anything about that, and there is no build diversity like Whitewing said. Its presence caused problems, its absence is going to cause different problems.
I agree with that.
To be fair, regarding the sweeping changes, I feel like they were going to have to do that anyway, no matter what, because of the economy changes. And
yes,
yeah,
true.
Let's not get into that. So there is something to be said about that. And the other thing I wanted to point out, which is something Morrow posted on Team Liquid, was that, yes, getting Storm in time in a game because you Chrono Boost correctly is part of skill, but so is having a build that times perfectly because you planned it beforehand, before you even got in the game, that also gets Storm in time for an attack or something. But it is true that the builds will be less varied. But skill-wise, we're losing not as much because it takes some of the skill you need in the game to adjust your build and puts it into planning out your build. But there will be less variety because you just have less decisions to make when you plan your build.
Yeah. So let's talk about the other. I think we've covered most of Chronoboost stuff. But we have to talk about the other major macro mechanic of Protoss in order to discuss how they're trying to compensate for the lack of it. So apart from rebalancing the actual build times in order to adjust for a world in which Chronoboost, the other thing they've done is they've modified the other major macro mechanic of Protoss, the warp gate. Now, warp gate is indeed a macro mechanic. It's a way of building units, and it's very interesting because it's the only front-loaded macro mechanic in the game. You click the button, you click it, the unit appears, and then you wait before you're allowed to start building the next one. So the fact that you can teleport units anywhere on the map, just spawn them in thin air, as long as you've got a power field, made this very, very powerful. Now, they've done the new change they put in, I actually think is a very good one. They've reduced the build time on offensive warp-ins by significant amount. I think it's 16 seconds now. So if I make a pylon outside your base and warp in a bunch of blink stalkers in order to blink all in, I've got to wait a quarter of a minute before I can even move those units. Meanwhile, you could be walking down, killing the pylon and all the units as they're warping in. In order to compensate for that, I have to build a gateway at that pylon.
Yeah.
It forces any sort of warp gate all in to be significantly more aggressive and risky because I have to risk a warp gate with the pressure. It costs 100 extra. I have to build my gateway out of my base, and I can't have pre-built it, or if I have pre-built it in my base, and then it's just a waste of 150 minerals on a gateway I can't use. So it significantly weakens early aggression, and I think this is going to be a precursor to gateway unit buffs, because a nerf of the Protoss unit aggression will allow them to, I think, buff gateway units to a point where you don't rely on things like the Colossus anymore, which they've already nerfed and you can't rely on anymore, etc. But at least I'm hoping that it's a redesign, going to be a buff to gateway units, so that make gateway units more core. But the part that compensate for the Chrono Boost is the defensive warp gate buff. So only taking 2 seconds to warp in units instead of 5 defensively next to a Nexus or warp gates means that I don't have quite as much of a rush of being, oh crap, I'm under attack, I need to chrono boost my warp gates in order to get units out a lot faster. It doesn't let me get any more units out over X period of time, but it does let me react a little bit slightly faster. It makes it more likely, less likely that my units die while warping in defensively before they're even done and ready to fight. I think based on the nerf offensively in warp gates and the defensive buff on gateways, it seems like it's going to be a precursor to a gateway unit buff, which could compensate for a lack of chrono boost. It will still change Protoss identity from a text based race to a more core army ground unit base, but I don't know. That's just my prediction. What do you guys have to say about
that? Makes sense.
Personally, I don't really like the change for a different reason. I think it's too complicated. It's simply like that. Like, there's some additional kind of non-intuitive condition that changes the behavior of a pylon based off a presence of another building next to it, like an add-on, but not exactly. And I would really prefer to find some different, more simpler solution to the problem.
I agree that it's really complicated, but I'm not entirely sure that there is a simpler solution. Because they've tried a whole bunch of simpler things and they just kind of haven't worked in beta. So I'm okay with them trying something.
Complex. My mod, but maybe let's leave it towards the end.
I mean, there are things you could do.
Yeah.
You could take the warp gate build time. So the cooldown after producing the unit with the warp gate, you could increase that dramatically, and then reduce the build time of units at a gateway. So it would be a strategic decision rather than a guarantee that you should change when to change gateways to warp gates and back and so on and so forth. So it would buff the defensive case because you'd be building it instead of gateway. The problem is that you'd have to be very careful because of proxy gateway strategies before warp gate. And you'd have to be careful about a few other things. And while that's more intuitive, Blizzard has been very clear that they want the dominant production mechanic to be using warp gates. They don't want you using gateways after the warp gate is done, the research done. They don't want you using gateways anymore. And they've been pretty unwilling to consider an alternative on that one. So I don't know that discussing an alternative is going to be fruitful in any way.
Well, I can tell you what I did, but... Well, in my StarCraft Improved mode, what I did is to add additional 100 mineral cost for transforming a gateway to a warp gate.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not.
So
I'm
what
not
it sure happens?
That's something to just.
So the thing is that
you material to the. I don't know that's material to the conversation of Warp Gate as a macro mechanic and the changes that are being made to interplay with Chrono Boost to discuss that cost. But I mean, I think like Whitewing's right? The core purpose of Warp Gate is central to the identity of Protoss in all of StarCraft II, right? It was in Wings of Liberty. It was in Heart of the Swarm. It will be in Legacy of the Void. I agree with your assessment that having that super non-intuitive function in how warping in works is really it's going to be very difficult to learn or understand. And it's interesting in a way, you know, that a lot of the changes they're making are supposed to be things that are really obvious to the viewer, right? I, as a casual observer of this game who doesn't even play it, should be able to watch and understand what's occurring. And there would be no rational way for a player to, or for a viewer, sorry, to understand at first glance why a unit takes 8 times as long to warp in at one pylon as opposed to another. Like, there's just no way for that to be a sensible interaction as a non-competitive player of StarCraft. So
I do want to point out that they are making the power field color change when it's empowered, so it should be a little bit more visible.
But you're not going to see that as a viewer. You're going to see that as a player.
Well, no, I mean, people watching the stream, people watching a live viewing, if you clicked on the power field or pylon or something and you see the different color
right,
power
that,
field,
that
would make it
a lot easier. Right, that's consistently also, clicking on a pylon.
You are correct. It does depend. You are correct.
It does
depend on the observer.
It's a simple understanding. Yeah. And I think that there is value in saying that, like, it's inconsistent with the direction that they've described, where we want the experience for players and viewers to be simpler and more fluid, and yet they're adding all these layers of additional complexity that are designed to in some way control for timings, which also seems really odd in the wake of removal of Chrono Boost. Like, after you take Chrono Boost away and I can no longer hit early warp gate timings, I can no longer quickly refresh my warp gates, and you can control the specific cooldown of a warp gate based on the unit you produce from it, why do we need all of these other layers? Like, the two don't go hand in hand. You either control the variable by selecting when we can get warp gate, selecting how quickly the warp gate refreshes after using the building, you know, control for global warp in timing, whether it's 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 8 seconds, whatever that number ends up being. But this seems like it's a very specific result of warp gate timings in a Chrono Boost era. And we're going to a non-Chrono Boost era and trying to solve for a Chrono Boost problem. Like, that's what it looks like.
The thing is, even without Chrono Boost, you want to give Protoss some way to attack with warp gates, because if we can't attack with warp gates, we can never, ever, ever attack anything until late game death roll, whatever.
So they gave it to the warp
printer. Yeah, but can we only use that? Like, I think that's a terrible direction.
It's the decision was you can either use a warp prism or you can so you need a robo to make the attacks a little later, or you can build a warp gate or a nexus at the front next to the pylon and then get regular and then get the fast speed of warp-ins.
Offensive photon overcharge. That's all I gotta say.
Just photon overcharge warp gate. All that. Yeah. Let's do it. No, but it's
Hass is like.
I'm also a little
Tempest is better.
I mean, They had to do another thing. Something else necessitated the warp gate change, and that was the economy changes. The problem here is that this whole thing stems back to the economy change, and it's difficult to come up with a more useful solution that doesn't buff the defensive case of the warp gate. Because Protoss right now is struggling ridiculously hard to take bases. Our units are the Protoss Bodies. Units are not mobile enough to bounce back and forth between bases to keep up with an aggressive force. Their army isn't really strong enough to do so. Adepts are really strong in the early game, but they only go so far before they start falling off hard. And if you don't have your adepts in place, even they with their ghost isn't going to get there in time to save anything. You still have to wait 7 seconds before the ghost teleport goes off, etc. They had to do something because Protoss was just dying left and right because they couldn't take bases and defend them. So their solution was to buff warp gates, which would make gateway units more mobile by being allowing them to produce them faster at defensive locations. But they couldn't just buff warp gate flat out because then aggression with warp gates would be way too strong. So you kind of wind up with this sort of forced kind of complex solution to a problem because of the economy changes. They wanted to speed up economic development, and Protoss as a race is not designed to be able to keep up with that sort of pace of economic development.
May I ask a question? Offensive use of warp gates, is it a problem of early game or is it a problem of the whole game?
It's an early game problem. It's an early mid game problem. To me, it's mostly an early game to mid game problem. Mm-hmm. It's not a mid to late, contrary to popular belief, it's not a mid to late game problem. If I'm 15 minutes into the game and we're in maxed armies back and forth, etc., being able to warp in unit reinforcements near the army is not really a problem because, frankly, they could just walk back before the battle ends anyway, which frequently is the case for Terran. Mm-hmm. It's the all-ins that come from like the blink stalker timings mm-hmm. where you're making units all because it's. To explain real quick, the warp gate only makes an advantage for the is really only a significant advantage for the first warp-in round of units. Mm-hmm. Because it cuts the reinforcement travel time for the first wave of units to get there. But once the first wave has been sent, you then have to wait for the cooldown, and the units could have walked across the map in that time anyway. So then the next wave comes in, and the first wave would have already been there. So it really gives you one extra burst of units at the engagement point when warp gate finishes the research. But after that point, it doesn't really speed anything up past just building units at your gateways and sending them across the map, etc.
Gateway units are not strong enough. That's a significant problem. Like this has been an argument that Protoss players have been having basically since the game came out. And the argument has always been, if you want to solve that, make it so that when you switch a gateway to a warp gate, it starts on cooldown, or make it so that when you produce a unit, it puts the gateway on cooldown and can't be transformed into a warp gate after you've built a unit. Like, there's been lots of proposed solutions that would have solved for that one timing window when warp gate research completes that is a problem. Outside of that, no one is upset about offensive warp-ins any more than they're upset about drop play from Terran or anything else. Like, the interplay is balanced against the relative strength of the Protoss units and their mobility and all of these other factors. Where they're being warped in on the map is semantics, because, like Whitewing said, like, they're just going to move. It doesn't matter.
I mean, it's the first wave that matters, because the first wave will get there sooner than it otherwise would have. But by the time the second wave has caught up, it's getting there, the first wave could have walked across the map in that time anyway. So the warp gate all-in will give you one extra wave of production compared to just using regular gateways at the time you attack, but it's only one extra production wave.
I disagree.
So consider what happens if I'm doing a blink stalker all-in, right? Mm-hmm. And I could have been making I made my gateway, my warp gates, and I warp in my initial wave of stalkers across the map, and then I go. Okay, mm-hmm. I could have made my stalkers with gateways in approximately the same length of time overall. The initial first wave right after gateways finishes is a little bit faster than having never switched to warp gates, because switching from gateways to warp gates is not instantaneous, and there's still that extra time second. But say I built them at base and then walked them across the map. I have to wait a little extra time for the first wave to get there compared to warping them in offensively. Mm-hmm. So the first wave gets there a lot faster by using warp gates. However, the second wave, which I produced on the other side of the map, is not an overall improvement in the forces compared to having just made it at home and sent across the walking across the map, because the first wave would have already made it across in that amount of time. So the effective warp gate on the all-in is having one extra wave of force of units at the location. It's only the one extra wave.
I disagree entirely. Entirely. No, because it's the issue, like, when you run into those classic moments where you have just, like, you know, PVZ, where you have just, like, 40 stalkers overrunning the third base and stuff like that, that's an issue with instant reinforcement and the fact that it slowly snowballs.
That's not instant reinforcement. You would have had stalkers streaming across the map to reinforce anyway if you didn't have the instant if you didn't have the teleport. You'd still be getting those same reinforcements.
Unless
yeah, but there's like counterplay to that.
I mean, it's effectively a parade push from Terran. I mean, Terran is still streaming units across the map. The first wave gets there a bit slower without the warp gate, but they still get the units there. They're still getting wave of reinforcements. They have one fewer wave of reinforcements based.
I think at any given instant point reinforcement and like slightly slower reinforcement is a huge difference.
The difference is one wave of units.
No, it builds up over time.
No, the extra ones are getting. No, it doesn't. It does not build up over time. The snowball effect starts because you're trading units constantly. You're splitting off enemy units and not losing stalkers because you're using blink micro to protect them. That's why the snowball effect happens, because your opponent's army isn't getting bigger. It's staying the same size because you're killing them about as fast as they're building, and your army is getting bigger. But that's not a product of the instant reinforcements. That's a product of just parade pushing. Terran has the exact same effect happen against Zerg when they're walking across the map with just spamming units nonstop, and they're trading off and not losing units, and the Zerg is losing them. It's no different than just a parade push.
I think maybe it's a combination of the two, honestly, because the difference is Terran is a lot less cost efficient compared to Protoss with the Blinkstalkers and stuff like that. Because you can do like an immortal push and lose almost nothing if you have hit perfect force fields. So,
I think that's not so much anymore, but
yeah, you know what I mean.
I think mathematically, this is really a difference of a one wave. Practically, there's a small additional benefit that you can react to whatever is happening on the battlefield faster. Like, suddenly you don't need blink stalkers, but you need, I don't know, zeros for whatever reason. Then you have that change immediately and don't have to wait for reinforcements to come.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, there is that practical difference as well. That is true. That's the other benefit. But in terms of the unit count, the only at any point in time, the only difference is one wave over just walking across the map with your reinforcements.
Yeah,
the Protoss units are a little weaker, so it's not really warp gate. Yeah, there's no problem there, but
that's a semantic factor too, because all the good Protoss units require production in your base, so the offensive, defensive warp-ins, the ability to use the warp-in mechanic is constrained specifically to those intentionally weaker units. Like, they are balanced around the availability of warp-in.
We had a problem with people talking over each other. No one wants to talk now?
I mean, overall, I think that removing Chrono Boost removes a lot of complexity from Protoss, but like, I don't think it's the end of the world. I dislike that change the most compared to Mules and Injex, but I think it's probably the least impactful change, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and that's why it seems like it's weird, because of the three, it was the least, like, it was. If all three of them were offenders, Chrono Boost was the least of them. It had the least impact on global game state as a macro mechanic. It offered the most flexibility, and as a natural trade-off for that, had to be the weakest of the three.
Yes. All right, but then, for the sake of consistency, you got to axe all three.
Yeah,
right. And I don't think they're axing all three because of Chrono Boost. I think we said already the only reason that they're going that direction is because of the change to spawn larva. Like, I think that's really the central reason that all of this is happening in the first place.
They've also, what Teo mentioned earlier, I think they've also realized that they probably pushed the economy development speed increase a little bit too far and need to slow it down a little bit. Personally, and this is just an opinion, not a fact or anything, I think the game would have benefited to Legacy of having a slower economic development pace than Heart of the Swarm and not a faster one. That's an esports intention change because people when watching games tend to have a smaller attention span and want the game. And when you're playing a best of seven or a best of five or a best of three or something, you need the games to end reasonably quickly. They can't be taking an extremely long time. So they were worried about game pacing for viewership, but I don't think it necessarily would have meant having a slower economic development that the games ended later because the mid game would have been dragged out. But that's a whole different discussion for another day. But I feel like they probably thought they pushed the envelope a little bit too far with economic pacing and needed to pull back a little bit. And rather than, as Teo said, reverting the economic changes, they felt that they could probably just revert mechanics and not kill two birds with one stone. And that's sort of what necessitates this complicated warp gate solution. And it's kind of unfortunate that you sometimes wind up with simple solutions not being optimal when you have a complex setup. But while the general rule of simple is better is usually true, sometimes simple doesn't work. And I think that's the situation we're hitting with warp gate. As long as they follow the rule they had of warp gate will be the predominant macro mechanic production for gateway units. And unless they're willing to pull back on that, you pretty much wind up with a solution like this that you have to have.
I still believe that additional costs on the warp gate transformation would be a solution.
How so?
Well, the thing is that if you want to go for some early warp gate aggression, you have to spend additional money on the transformation rather than the additional wave of units. So your army is that much slower by like 3 or 4 blink stalkers.
It's basically the supply tax. He's adding an extra supply tax is what he's doing effectively. From what I mentioned earlier.
I think that would still have like defensive problems with that as well, I think.
Defender has 400 additional minerals to spend on defense.
Are we assuming that Warpgate and Gateway have the same times? Because even if it cost me 100 to make a Warpgate, I would definitely make that after getting like 3 or 4 Warpgates because it would just be better than having Gateways.
Actually,
at some points you want to do that, but that's an investment which makes your attack that much weaker.
There's also situations when you line up your production with an opponent's attack so it kicks in at the right time. For example, the 2 medivac timing for Terran. If you notice, pro games, they'll have 6 gates completing exactly as soon as when the medivacs are like halfway through the map, and then they warp in 1 or 2 rounds of units and they're fine. And when you make warp gate transformation cost money for that, you just throw that kind of build completely out as well. So it can be a solution, but it opens up a bunch more things, which really end up being kind of unpredictable.
Well, I don't think you can outright say build orders have to change, right?
Yeah, but like I don't think you can say we need arbitrarily putting Protoss X 100 minerals behind in the mid game is going to consistently improve things. Like, maybe we just warp in a bunch more sentries before going, and we go with the second round of warp ins instead of the first. I don't know. But it doesn't seem like the most elegant solution to me.
No, it's a solution that's also very much contextually framed by the current state of the game in Heart of the Swarm and not any of the proposed changes in Legacy of the Void, which is part of our problem is that we're trying to assess that change kind of in two separate vacuums, and you can't assess it in a vacuum, let alone two. the Chrono Boost versus Warp Gate push-pull thing has, I think, caused a lot of the balance changes over the years that we've seen in previous iterations and patches of the game, and led us to a place now where we don't actually understand what the game would look like without all of the limitations that have been imposed by Chrono Boost, by Warp Gate, by Force Field. Like, they're so inherent to the race and the identity of the race, and all of those macro things affect why we have the game we have today. And fundamentally, I don't think the game is actually incredibly imbalanced or anything right now. I think people are, for the most part, looking at the state of Heart of the Swarm and asking for minor iterative changes. And a lot of the big changes that we're seeing are driven by, and I think we're going to come to this eventually, making it into a better game as a viewer.
It seems they're pretty focused on the viewer in it. I'll agree with that. Okay, so why don't we wrap things up a bit in a minute by everyone will go around and choose one change that they would make. That we won't discuss. We won't discuss the changes themselves. Just an idea for people to consider for the future. So just one change you would make and why, and then we'll move on to the next person, and then we'll take questions. So, Chris.
Of course, you would pick me first. all right. To be honest, like I don't think that Inject Larvae needs to be in the game at all.
Chris would kill Inject.
I have no problem with it. Like it's just it literally is the most useless thing, and putting it as an autocast for you to just leave a queen sitting in your base makes no sense. I mean, I understand there might be some issues if they completely axed Inject but left queen in the game. The queens would become way too strong because you just make three queens at the beginning of the game and they'd have tons of energy for transfuse and could defend anything. But
okay, so in short,
I think it's bad.
So axe Inject and then balance around an axed Inject. Okay. Yes. Teo.
I'm actually okay with Inject existing. I would like it to be way less prevalent, so maybe it gives you one or two larvae instead of 7 or 8 or whatever it is. But I don't want it to be autocast. I want it to be something that serves too. I can live with that. But it should be like, it shouldn't be twice as much larvae. It should be like 30% more larvae or something. That would be worth testing.
What change would you make? What change would you make given what the Blizzard stated they're doing now anyway, from deviating from what they're doing now?
Not make Inject autocast, but make it manually cast. Something like that.
Okay. William.
Well, I would also... one of the most important changes for me is also the larva Inject. I would actually make it autocast, but make it so that it can be casted only on a hatchery that has at most three larva. So the moment that your larva pops up, you actually have to spend it onto some kind of units. You have to make a decision right there in order for an next larva Inject to actually occur automatically or manually.
So you would lower the larva cap from 19 to 5 or 7 or whatever?
Not exactly. The thing is that currently, even if you're on a cap, you can still cast the larva Inject. Right?
But it doesn't have any effect. It doesn't really have much of an effect if you're at the cap. It just, the larva pop off and die.
Yeah, but you can still cast it, and then you still have 40 seconds to build up some units.
So you practically speaking, you effectively have a cap of 23 if you're careful. But
yeah.
So, but you effectively, what you're suggesting is you would reduce the cap to like 3, and then maybe, and then any, if you have extra larva over, they die if you don't use them in 20 seconds or something like that.
No, they are still there, but you don't cast the Inject. You cannot cast an Inject if there are more than 3 larva.
So you want to decrease the cap to 5, and then you can't cast anymore, or 7, and then you can't use larva Inject until you spent them.
Yeah.
Okay.
So effectively, it means that the Zerg does not have to click on all its queens all the time, which is really taxing and annoying. But he still has to pay attention where the Inject occurs in order to transform the larva into units, which is mechanically an easier operation, and there is more choice in that operation.
Okay, I see what you mean.
I'm not certain that would change much, but we'll see. Well, we can talk about this later. Odin.
Interestingly, I think Lilium and I are on kind of the same page, but in very different ways. The problem I've always had with Inject, and I think Inject is the error in all of this. It's the source of the problem and the reason they're talking about macro mechanic adjustments. I don't want to see any of them removed. I think they're good for the game. I think they're part of the gameplay that we've come to know and love. What I would love to see them do with Inject is make it so that the charges of larvae actually accumulate on the queen as opposed to on the hatchery. And then when you choose to use the spawn larvae ability, the number of larvae that are spawned are controlled by the queen's charges that it's held up to a, you know, a maximum theoretically of maybe more than what we have right now. But so that the punitive feeling of not casting Inject on time is removed. If you do not cast Inject every 40 seconds or whatever it is now, you're not losing anything because those larvae are actually stored on the queen and can be quickly put onto the hatchery. And if you can only spawn them in, for example, waves of four, if that's still the cap that Blizzard wants to have, then the relative amount of time that it would take for the larvae to spawn would be reduced by the amount of time that the queen hasn't had that spell on the hatchery itself. So in theory, you could have two back-to-back injects and make a really scary push happen or something, but the timing would be no different in terms of when it would hit than if you would just cast Inject on cooldown. It just eliminates that feeling of 5 seconds of missed Inject is 5 seconds you never get back, because that's the flaw with that macro mechanic relative to all of the others, in my opinion.
Okay. For me, the change I would make is switching the Disruptor with the Reaver.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Actually, I would delete Zerg from the game.
That works.
That's solid.
I'm just kidding again.
That's good game design.
Easier to balance two raises than three. This man's a genius.
I would like to see Zergs building more macro hatcheries rather than relying on queens for injects. Frankly, what I would probably do is just increase the rather than the changes mentioned, is I would increase the energy cost of a creep tumor and a inject to 50. And allow inject to spawn just like the 4 or 8 larva. Four now, given the other changes they've made, or 8 if we went back to where it was before. And that way you'd only have to inject half as often. And a few missed seconds wouldn't be as punishing. But, I mean, there's a few other things you could do. I'd like to see more macro hatcheries rather than injects, frankly. Remove the queen from the game and give Zerg Hydralisks at tier 1 and do put it. The Roach to tier 2.
Do it.
Whoa.
Change the Zerg race entirely so that it's not Zerg anymore.
Brood War Zerg.
Is a brood warrior up in here, yeah.
Yeah, forget that. Let's just make it Protoss. We'll just have 2 Protoss races. Then we can hear Terran whine twice as much.
Protoss and other Protoss. Alright, so we've gone over that. I was mostly joking with most of that, but yeah. Why don't we take questions? If anyone has any questions they'd like to ask, now would be the time. Let me check Twitter and see if anyone sent one.
It's probably a little bit of a delay, so we'll have to just kind of hang out and wait for people to get a chance to hear that and ask a question back. But
in the meanwhile, I will scroll through random things on Team Liquid, and people can read people's comments. Isn't this exciting?
It's interesting. It's been interesting to me reading the commentary on the removal of macro mechanics, because everybody I've read who has actually played with them has said, like, at an amateur level at least, is, you know, it's not really better or worse. It's just different. It has pros, it has cons. And they're thinking about it mostly in terms of what they're spending their time on in the game. Because, like, I think it was Whitewing that said earlier, like, you have a fixed amount of attention and you're going to spend all of it. You're not going to not use that time. So there is that element to it that people who have actually played with it, I think, have commented on more accurately than some people who are just speculating. But I think there's a lot of that speculation from a design perspective that really feels like the good ideas about how to do things for the health of the game aren't necessarily being heard.
Hashtag right wing. I like it. you make an extra point. The biggest complaint we hear about these changes isn't that the changes are bad from a strategy design perspective or a game design perspective. The biggest complaint is that they're afraid that pros won't be able to show off their APM enough. That you won't be able to differentiate between great and amazing players and just the merely very good players, because the great ones won't be able to inject really hard and come up with a huge swarm of units, whereas the merely very good players who couldn't do it before will just be playing just as well. But really, I mean, the ones who were doing it, like Sue, didn't really have better, more APM or just more skill. They were just prioritizing better. They understood that the injects were the priority and not injecting was the incorrect decision, even if it meant that your army was controlled better. And I feel like if that's the case, then inject isn't really adding anything to the game for the viewer. And for the player, it's not adding anything. It's merely shifting things.
Right. I think the fundamental underpinning of that argument comes down to the fact that people really want to see StarCraft as a sort of high pressure real time strategy, and that's always been the differentiator in the genre, right? Is that these people don't want to play Civ 5 and take turns picking religions. Like, they want something that moves very quickly and has that demand, and macro mechanics were a way of demonstrating that demand. And for a lot of people, myself included, I prefer that to the new design paradigm, especially as a Protoss player, where every single one of my units has to have a separate micro castable ability. Mm-hmm. So I'm no longer actually managing the strategy of the interplay between economy, resources, technology, upgrades, and army and units. Those three wings are now, you know, not the same level of attention is being spent on the three, because they really just want me to figure out when to cast the individual spells on my individual units. And I don't think that's good gameplay.
I think they should focus on its actual unit positioning and movement, not necessarily activated abilities, but how units move over the map. And actually having more expansions goes into that way, because there's a decision where you expand and how you defend your expansion. But more focus on unit movement and positioning, that should be a continuation of that.
I mean, they did a really good job of that in Heart of the Swarm with some of the changes they made, like the changes to Mutalisks allowed them to move a little faster, gave Zerg players the ability to take a more dominant form of map control and exert a real zoning pressure on their opponents in ways that weren't possible before. I think the game has evolved in that direction, but at this point now, the game is now focusing on the individual, like, castable abilities, the individual hard counterplay, which I know has been discussed to death, of having units that counter units in very specific ways, but also trying to dumb that down and not have the Immortals never lose to tanks problem. Like, there's all these things that they can't seem to pick a direction and stick to it. And I'm all for having some level of counterplay, some level of positional requirements, some level of strategic decision making, but all of those things at this point are coming at the expense of just raw mechanics in the game. Your ability to macro well is going to matter less in the face of, did you hit, you know, prismatic alignment at the right time or not? And that isn't as compelling to me as a player, nor as a viewer.
Okay, so we do have a couple questions here. You can get into. The first one doesn't really pertain to the discussion, but I'll field it anyway. Puck Supernova and Kiwi Cocky have all said that the most OP build in Legacy of the Void is the Proxy Void Adept build. How would you change the game to balance that build? Well, first, I'm not convinced it's that overpowered, because there hasn't been that much time for people to figure out how to defend it yet. And typically, this is pretty fun discussion to have, so I'll get into this very briefly. Typically, there's a pattern that follows with strategies in what typically is referred to as a metagame, but that word's misused. It's more of like a trend of play, in that somebody comes up with a very powerful, aggressive build that does really well. While you can't have started working on a defensive strategy to respond to that until you've seen it. So figuring out an optimal defense for strategy takes a good while to do. Just as it takes a while to figure out the offensive strategy, but you can't start till the offensive strategy is completed. Somebody comes up with a really cool attack, and then it takes a while before anyone figures out a really good, solid way to defend it. and then eventually it fades into nothingness, or it turns out that there is no solid defense, and then it's a balance problem that needs to be modified. With the current changes, I don't think it works nearly as well anymore, because without Chrono Boost, you can't get the start, you can't get the Void Ray out as quickly. You can't get Warp Gate done quite as quickly to get the adept count up really high. And with the, I don't think the offensive Warp Gate change is a problem, because if you're proxying a Stargate, you can proxy a gateway. But the offensive Warp Gate change will change a bit, because your proxy pylon that's as forward as possible probably won't have a gateway with it, so that'll also nerf it a bit. So I think it's probably already nerfed with the current wave of changes enough that it won't be problematic. What's everybody's favorite micro aspect of Brood War, which isn't in StarCraft II? Teo.
I'm actually not entirely sure which one individually.
Something from Protoss.
Fun, but they're morons. Yeah, probably Reaver micro. Yeah, let's go with that.
Shuttle Reaver. I thought you were gonna say Arbiter Recall.
No, I can do it as an SC2, kind of. Close enough.
Okay.
But like Reavers are my second favorite Protoss unit behind High Templar, so.
Alright. Anyone else have a micro interaction from Brood War that they really wish was in StarCraft 2?
I didn't really play a lot of Brood War, but I really do enjoy the whole Mutalist micro aspect. It's like the most difficult thing in the entire freaking world, but it's really fun to do, and I wish that StarCraft 2 mutas weren't like kind of dumb when they attacked.
I think there's two that are interesting. Obviously the carriers, which have been talked to death, and everybody knows about carrier leashing and how that worked in Brood War. I also really liked vultures in Brood War, and how you could have the unit that sort of like skidded to a halt within a closer range and then sort of sustained range on a target because of that, and like the acceleration and deceleration on vultures was really cool and something that hasn't been, I don't think, adequately replicated in StarCraft 2. Not that like it's not a good or bad thing that it's not in the game, but it was a really cool thing in Brood War that could have carried over really interestingly.
I have three words: hold, position, lurkers.
That works.
Just watch massacres of Marines. Lillian, do you have anything?
They're kind of going to have that, maybe, in Legacy, kind of.
Maybe.
I haven't noticed that the lurkers are able to hold their fire.
They have a button.
Do they?
I think they have a button.
Yeah. The last time I tried to play them. Okay, so I haven't played with lurkers in a while because they're totally unnecessary to make right now, but...
They were super ridiculous in the very first Legacy build that was playable at BlizzCon. Them and the original Disruptor were just silly. Like, there was no reason to build any other units. It was unreal.
I've been pretty much when I play Zerg, just like mass Zergling Baneling Muta into Vipers and laughing at everyone because of how ridiculous the Viper is right now. When I'm playing against Protoss, I just make lots of Roaches and Ravagers.
That's good.
Sorry.
Ravagers are so dumb.
Ravagers are pretty good.
Dumb.
When the Terran max apply, the depot will no longer give value while the Mew had. Will that be a problem? No, because by that point in the game, the scans were really what you wanted in anyway. Because when you're at max army, information is everything. You want to see where your opponent is. You want to see how to engage. You want to know if they're trying to sneak around you or whatever. You just want as much vision and information as possible. Scan is the king of the late game. Mules in the late game will mean the Terran army, and this was another question that somebody asked. With mules being removed from the game, late game Terran will be a lot weaker. It might even need a buff. I'm not sure. But at the very least, with the extra scans they'll be using, they'll at least be safer than they were before relying on mules. So I don't know if that'll balance out or not.
There was already sort of like a useful boundary on things like when you would stop muling because you've already pooled the resources necessary. And I think this goes back even to that earlier question about the proxy void adept build. Like, there's a lot of this stuff that's in the game today, and we already see those relationships. Like, you can't counter proxy builds if you don't scout them. Every scouted proxy build is easy to counter, but people don't scout them. Same thing with late game mule usage. There's already a sort of upper boundary on when it's effective to mule. As the player who is either tied or ahead, if you were the player who's behind, you mule aggressively. But if you are in a lead, you're attempting to contain your opponent, you cease muling in favor of scans, because that's that information imbalance becomes more important to you than the resources. So it's kind of, that's not a change, I don't think. I think the behavior in game will play out basically exactly the same. It's just that the breakpoint occurs earlier with supply call down than it does with mule.
Fair enough.
We got any other questions in there? I'm looking, but I don't see them. How are you supposed to claim GG without calling mules into your enemy's base? We don't know. We don't.
You just spam as many scans until it looks like the frickin' sun is over his base.
That's right, the bomber scan.
Yeah. Or maybe you just bring out the manner CC. That's kind of what Protoss does.
It's not the same.
Back in Wings of Liberty, I used to proxy Mothership in their base.
You can put 6 item pods in his base.
Yeah, how do you possibly repair your offensive predator? Well, you build SCVs on it. And you can drop SCVs in there, too.
You float orbital with SCVs in it forward.
Yeah, and then you put SCVs, you load it into it before you fight it.
Mules anymore.
All right, that seems like that's been most of the questions.
Yep.
So, Odin, why don't you plug your stuff?
Yeah, for sure. So, I guess for anybody who doesn't know me or my background and why I'm suddenly on this show with these guys, my name is Odin, and I do a lot of high-level StarCraft coverage for Team Acer. I'm also the full-time game journalist covering all Blizzard game news for Icy Veins, which is sort of the premier World of Warcraft guide site, and also does a ton of really good Hearthstone content. So lots of my work is over there. I freelance other places. I also host a really popular Hearthstone podcast called Well Met. We record Sunday nights at 7 Pacific, 10 Eastern. You can come check that out. We'll be doing a show tomorrow on all the new cards from the Grand Tournament that were revealed on Friday. And if you want to track me down, I'm on Twitter at Lack of Realism, and my Twitch channel is Odin TV with two N's, so Odinn TV. And I stream not very often, but Hearthstone, Heroes, StarCraft, even a little WoW sometimes. Blizzard owns my soul.
Do you have anything to add, Lillian?
Or anything? Well, about myself.
Yes, plug yourself.
Well,
feel free.
Basically, an average Team Liquid forum user. I don't have Twitch. I don't do any fancy stuff that you guys do. My main focus was doing the double harvesting mode and then hot mineral harvesting mode. And now I'm currently working on StarCraft Improved, which is a more complex balancing around a new economy that I'm trying to do with the community. And you can find the thread again at at Team Liquid in the custom maps section. And any feedback from you guys and from the viewers would be awesome as well.
Cool.
That's basically it that I'm doing regarding gaming. Otherwise, writing up my PhD and non-game related stuff.
You're writing your dissertation?
Yep. But
what's your dissertation on?
Programming languages.
Cool.
That's pretty hardcore.
That's pretty hardcore, not gonna lie.
Dissertations in general are pretty hardcore.
Yeah, that's true.
But okay. So yeah, it seems like we care about it. You know where to find the rest of us. We're all on Team Liquid, Team Liquid strategy team. So thanks for coming, everyone. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, guys.